Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, June 7th. Last week, much of the country took note of the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa race massacre. For many Americans, it was the first time they had heard about this atrocity that has not been taught in history class very much. But much of last week's coverage still tended to treat the Tulsa massacre as a discrete event. So today, right now, we want to try to go further and try to put it into a larger historical context. New York Times columnist Jamel Bowie always writes with an eye on historical context. Writing last year about Tulsa's 99th anniversary, Jamel noted that the historian Danny Goebel argued that the Tulsa massacre was best seen against the backdrop of at least 10 lesser-known pogroms in other Oklahoma towns that had drenched the decade leading up to Tulsa in 1921 in African-American blood. And yes, that quote used the word pogrom. Jamel also noted that the historian Goebel likened the Tulsa attack to the murderous pogroms that the Russian Empire unleashed on Jewish communities during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. In both cases, the authorities hoped to drive out despised minorities by allowing marauders to kill and loot at will, wrote the historian Goebel. These days, Jamel Bowie is on parental leave from the Times, cradling a one-month-old, he tweeted recently, but did at least get to tweet about some of this during the massacre anniversary, and he is good enough to tip his work and life balance a little more toward work for these coming minutes. So, Jamel, we always appreciate it when you come on, and we really appreciate it when you're on leave. So welcome back to WNYC.
It's my pleasure.
Would you talk more about the term that you have used several times to understand attacks like these, racial pogrom? Why is pogrom an important word here?
I think it's an important word because it can help distinguish this kind of collective racial violence from other forms of racial violence from the period. I think it is tempting, and this isn't a bad thing. I think it reflects sort of people becoming aware of this larger history of racial violence, but it's very tempting to flatten events like Tulsa, Elaine, Arkansas a few years earlier, the East St. Louis riot of 1917, to flatten that and put it in the same context, let's say the Colfax massacre in Louisiana in 1873, or the New Orleans riot in 1866, right? There are these episodes of collective anti-Black violence, and I think there's a real temptation to kind of put them, like smash them all together as a singular thing. A word like pogrom, what it does is it helps distinguish, sort of emphasize what's different about these things, what makes them distinctive versus the anti-Reconstruction riots in the 1870s and 1860s versus lynching in the 1890s and 1900s, why this is a distinct kind of violence. And I think it is a distinct kind of violence in that it's not only collective, but it's essentially state-sanctioned, and it's very much aimed at erasing a population versus a lynching, which typically weren't about removing Black Americans from an area, but reinforcing the race hierarchy under which they lived.
One of the events that you just mentioned was Colfax, Louisiana, 1873. According to a Washington Post article that you tweeted out, it was a massacre of an estimated 62 to 81 African Americans, and it says it was a direct attack on Black men getting the right to vote during Reconstruction. It describes Black state militia holed up around the local courthouse to protect the local government after whites contested the results of the election of 1872. This is starting to sound familiar. And then on Easter Sunday, those protectors of the courthouse were surrounded by a white mob that set the courthouse on fire and shot anyone who emerged, 62 to 81 people killed. My question is, how central to the era of racial pogroms that we're talking about was the very fact of post-Civil War constitutional changes giving black men the right to vote?
So for this period in the 1910s and 1920s, which is largely post the First World War after 1917, by this point, as compared to Colfax or New Orleans or any of the 1870s episodes of collective racial violence, which were taking place during a time of sort of serious and intense political contestation in the South. And so it's sort of like how the South would be, whether it would be a biracial democracy with equal rights, whether it would be a white supremacist democracy, right? That was still a live question. But by the time you get to Tulsa, for example, that question's more or less been settled in the South. Jim Crow has been passed into law by 1910, is sort of when the last of the laws fall into place. There's already been constitutional change away from the Reconstruction constitutions beginning in 1890 with the Mississippi Constitution, which is the first sort of Jim Crow constitution and kind of continuing over the next two decades. And so kind of the political landscape and largely the social landscape has already been set. Things might be a little different in Oklahoma on account of it still being very much a frontier land and in some senses unsettled, not like as far as people, but in terms of its political status quo. Mm-hmm. But Jim Crow is in place at this point. And so I think, you know, that's part of why I think it should be considered in sort of a different kind of category than what you saw in the 19th mm-hmm. century, because it's not as if the race hierarchy has been it's been seriously challenged at this point. This is, I think, this kind of violence is as much about competition over land and resources, right, as much as it is sort of just plain racism or hatred.
Yeah. By the way, about Colfax, as I was reading through that description, you know, I read echoes of January 6th when you talk about whites contesting an election of 1872 and then attacking the people who were protecting the courthouse where I guess those records were being kept. Should I read that into it, or is that a stretch?
No, I think that's a... I don't think that's a stretch. I think that the January 6th violence, the incursion on the Capitol, ought to very much be put in conversation with Colfax, with other violence in Louisiana. Colfax is sort of like the most famous instance, but the next year there's a similar attempt to basically remove the Republican governor of the state, and this ends up succeeding. They fail then. Mm-hmm. The White League, as it's called, but 2 years later they succeed through a combination of violence and fraud by putting quote unquote redeeming Louisiana and putting a Democrat in office. And I think that violence, which is very much against the idea that Black Americans are legitimate members of the polity, that they can exercise power, that they can make claims on the state, that their representatives are kind of de facto illegitimate. I think that should very much be put in conversation with January 6th and a movement that both in quiet ways and loud ways, it's essentially saying that the elected representatives of particular Americans are kind of de facto illegitimate and cannot wield or hold power.
Another one you mentioned in your first answer was Elaine, Arkansas, one, again, lost to history as far as most Americans growing up and learning history are concerned. But as the Washington Post cited last week, a massacre of 200 black farmers and their family members slaughtered, and it says one of the worst of dozens of attacks, dozens, in what was known as the Red Summer of 1919. So now we're already up into the era leading right up to Tulsa, which was 2 years later. Can you describe what Red Summer refers to?
Sure. The Red Summer refers to, I mean, like think words, refers to a summer. The summer of 1919, roughly May to September, when you have basically a wave of episodes of collective racial violence in Georgia, in Washington, D.C., in Chicago is one of the larger ones. And the precipitating factor for much of this is the return of black veterans from the war in Europe. And so many of the incidents involve, you know, a black veteran coming into town, asserting themselves, and you know, incurring violence from whites as a result. And every individual incident is complicated because, of course, through all this, there are also these questions of land and resources. But that's generally kind of the thing that unites them all. Elaine, for example, is one of the ones where it's very much about labor power and political power, a group of farmers essentially trying to unionize for themselves, are attacked. And there's sort of community-wide violence. But I think, you know, they go back to a point that I made at the beginning. This is why it's important very much not to flatten this stuff all out, because not only are the specific circumstances and context for each incident are a little different, but also the purpose of the violence varies as well. And so I think it's worthwhile to distinguish between violence essentially meant to eliminate a community. That would be Tulsa. That would be the I'm probably pronouncing this wrong, but Ocoee massacre in Florida in 1920, I believe. That would be the Forsyth County, Georgia killings in 1912, where they basically the entire black population of Forsyth County was removed. And I would say that we should extend the timeline here even further. Mm-hmm. There's a pretty well-regarded book by sociologist named James Lowen called Sundown Towns, and it's about this phenomena of towns throughout the Midwest, Indiana, Illinois, largely where black populations were driven out basically to the nearest city. And I would consider that to be in the same category of violence of Tulsa, something not just meant to reaffirm hierarchies, but really to just remove an entire group of people under cover of law, or with some sort of state sanction entirely.
Olivia in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Olivia.
Hi. Yeah, this is all very interesting to me. I called in because basically over the last year, for a couple of reasons, I've been tasked with doing some sort of family history. My family, I'm from North Carolina, live in New York, staying in New York. I'm from North Carolina and have generations of ties to Wilmington, North Carolina, where there was a massacre, not a riot, a massacre in 1898. And one of the things that has come out is a family member of ours, I've never really discussed with myself, we just didn't get into details. I come from a very progressive family, at least my immediate family, very liberal, very progressive. But one of the things I've learned just recently is that Roger Moore, who was the head of the KKK of Wilmington and the head of the Red Shirts, who basically was responsible for massacring many black people, it was my grandmother's first, my grandmother's cousin, basically, her grandfather. And this woman is someone who I grew up spending a ton of time with. And she was a social worker. She was someone who was a social justice warrior, back in the day. She's now passed away, but her grandfather was the head of the KKK. And, you know, this person was in business with my great grandfather. Who worked in real estate, and they had a building supply company. And it's so interesting in our family. It was always Roger Moore, was it sort of involved in that thing that happened, in that he helped, prevent deaths, a certain number of extra deaths. He guarded the prison or did something. But what has become really clear to me, doing some more research, actually just sort of around some land my family owns, which is totally unrelated, but has come into the picture. I I watched Wilmington on Fire, Chris Everett's 2015 documentary. Mm-hmm. I'm reading Wilmington's Lie right now. And I had a conversation with my dad about this weekend. And it's just, I had no idea. Growing up, I'm 37 years old. This is sort of like the first I've ever heard of this connection in my family to what is like the most disgusting thing to have happened in Wilmington, I'm assuming. I don't know.
Can I ask, but, Olivia? I mean, the,
yeah,
you know, the sort of romantic notion of doing your family genealogy as it pertains to race is that, oh, a lot of white people are discovering that they have some black ancestry, some Native American ancestry, and it's changing people's perspectives for the better on things. And that's definitely happening. But we don't hear stories like this very much. So I wonder what it's actually been like for you to just discover in the last year that you have an ancestor who is head of the Ku Klux Klan.
I mean, really pretty sickening. Like, I did some, I was on my computer and I was looking some stuff up, and I actually got sick to my, it felt a little sick to my stomach. And, you know, I've been kind of obsessively going down this rabbit hole at this point. My poor husband's like, what are you doing? What are you trying to do here? And, you know, it's, if anything, it's like, it just makes me, you know, I do as much as I can today to do the right thing. You know, we give to causes, we are allies, we do all this, but like, at the same time, this almost makes me want to like double down on my efforts, and, you know, maybe get a little more specific, maybe do some stuff like in Wilmington, mm-hmm. To try to make up for this part of my family. Because, yeah, and, you know, it didn't necessarily, I didn't sort of hear, it didn't come about because I heard, like, an inkling of this. It came about because I was looking up deeds about some unrelated land outside of Wilmington. And I just started to be like, oh, my great-grandfather did this. Well, he did some real estate in Wilmington. Well, how is this person related to this person? And then this name came up. And, you know, so it's not like it was obvious necessarily. At the same time, it's totally obvious, and I'm surprised I haven't heard about this. I don't know if it's just, yeah, something that like the younger generations just didn't want to talk about. It's certainly like my grandmother's cousin I mentioned before, you know, she's a social worker, she was a family therapist, like she did the good work. Right. And my mom, mm-hmm, almost said, I wonder if she wasn't just trying to like make up, mm-hmm, for the horrors committed in, you know, not her father's generation necessarily that I know of yet,
yeah,
but her grandfather.
I mean, and there are so many stories of people who have things in the family that for whatever reason they become ashamed of, and they never actually get handed down orally. And a lot of times those stories get lost. And sometimes people like you do the genealogy and some of them, you know, kind of reappear. Olivia, I have to go, but we really appreciate your candor. This is, I think, an important story for people to hear, even though it's a story of you and one family. So we really appreciate you being a first-time caller, and please call again.
Thank you.
Jamel, we're almost out of time. Any thought about Olivia's story? Put it in any kind of context or anything else you want to say as we wrap this up?
I think I'll make a point that's been made many times before by many people, which is that the history of racial violence in the United States, the history of white supremacist organizations, history of all these things, this is not black history, right? It's not specifically for black Americans. It's an American story, and it's relevant to everyone who calls this country home, not just because of perhaps direct connections and direct relatives might be involved in some of these things, but because they shape the world in which we live. You don't have to take you know, a hyper-determinist view of things, to recognize that events like Tulsa and like Elaine and like Wilmington have a lasting influence on the life of the nation, on our civic understanding, and our sense of ourselves as democratic citizens. And so I think it's important for us to learn this stuff, not to sort of create any kind of guilt or anything, but to really have a better sense of what it means to live in this country with its particular history.
And does, I'll follow up by asking, does opening our national eyes to events like all these from history help foster equality for the future? Because I know one of the things that I hear critically in some media, depends on your media outlet, is, well, these things may have happened, but focusing on them this much just divides people and makes it harder to bring equality for the future. I'm guessing you have a different take on that.
I do. I think in learning these things, I've spent much of the last like 5 or 6 years, especially really learning about this stuff. It's certainly possible that people can learn about this stuff and feel embittered or angered, but I don't think that's how most people take away these things they learn about them, and I don't think that's the reaction they should have. I think that an essential part of living in a democratic society, lowercase d democratic society, is its members feeling like they receive equal respect from the society in which they live, equal respect, equal consideration. And if whitewashing away histories of racial violence that have had a real material impact on people's lives, if that is a thing that makes it difficult from a variety of angles to engender that kind of respect, right? The victims and their descendants feeling like they've been neglected, feeling like they haven't been able to receive any repair from the society, others looking at the impact and the consequences of that violence and kind of, you know, maybe saying, well, the reason why these people don't have are poor, the reason why these people are disadvantaged is because they don't work, they don't take care of themselves, right? Mm-hmm. That the snowball effect of ignoring these things, ignoring their impacts, can be such that it kind of erodes respect and equal consideration, our sense of ourselves as fully, as citizens who have full status in society. And I think that learning about these things and grappling with them is part of restoring that and of building a culture of equality that we can use to help actually realize equal treatment. So I kind of fundamentally disagree with that. If nothing else, we have kind of a control, right? That we actually did spend like a century ignoring stuff, yeah, and burying it under the rug, and lo and behold, it did not make for a more equal society. So maybe doing the opposite is what we got to try now.
New York Times columnist Jamelle Bouie, currently on paternity leave. I'm also a fan of your Saturday newsletter, by the way, which also often has a lot of history in it. When do we get these things back?
July. I'm off of leave. I'm back to work in July. So pretty soon I will be back to writing and sending out newsletters.
Well, congratulations on the baby. And thanks so much for taking the time out to join us for this. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.